Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Whole Scoop Radio with your host, Carol Ferraci, your health and wellness resource, where you get the whole scoop and nothing but the scoop.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. We are The Whole Scoop Health and Wellness Radio Show on Blog Talk Radio. I am Carol Ferraci, your host. If you haven't listened to us before, then you should know that everything that we do, all the guests that we have, are highly credentialed. That is the stipulation for being on this show, so that you get the best information that I can find and the latest and greatest. That is absolutely true and accurate, so we go from there. I am Carol Ferraci, registered licensed dietitian. Not going to tell you how long I've been practicing because it's way too long. You'll find me at www.naturallynutritioninc.com if you want to look that up, and that would be nice. So tonight we are going to talk about inflammation and chronic illness. What's food got to do with it? I know that's something that y'all have been thinking about, but no, seriously, you know, everybody has their own ideas about food, but what you may not know about the foods that you eat may be the things, the very things that are not making you feel so great. So I'm going to tell you, because I got to do the business here, let me remind you that while our guests are highly credentialed on the topics we discuss, it's always recommended to seek medical advice prior to implementing any and all interventions discussed on this program. The call-in number, if you're listening online, is 347-855-8894. That's 347-855-8894. You can also direct questions and comments to our Facebook Blog Talk Radio page, which is the Whole Scoop Blog Talk Radio group. And, you know, just join us and tell us what you like to hear. Tell us what you heard, and if you want to hear more or you want to hear less, or, you know, you want us to shape it differently, let us know. It's the Whole Scoop Blog Talk Radio group. We also have a webpage, thewholescoopradio.com. That's where you're going to find most of the information on the guests on this show, because I learned a long time ago that we have to kind of cut down. We have such great people on this show, and they have such accomplishments that, you know, I could spend – I was, when I started the show, spent a whole lot of time reading credentials. So check it out on the webpage, thewholescoopradio.com. Again, the number to call in is 347-855-8894. We will be taking questions later on in the show. If you want, call in on that number, 347-855-8894. And if you want to ask a question, remember to press the number 1. To become part of the queue for questions that lets me know you have a question. And at that time, I'll call out the last 4 digits of your telephone number so that you know that it's you that's going to be on air. Okay, great. Tonight, Susan Linke is with us. I am so excited because she's just, I got to tell you, she's a fabulous, fabulous person. Aside from being so highly qualified and such a plethora of information, she's just a fabulous person. I know her personally. I'm proud to call her a friend, but I'm also going to tell you that she's a registered licensed dietitian who for the last 13 years has worked with chronic inflammatory conditions, the very topic we're talking about tonight. And she uses a variety of modalities, including food sensitivities, nutrient deficiencies, and gut dysbiosis. She's a certified LEAP therapist and a mentor for many other dietitians, including myself. She received her MBA from Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas, and a Master's of Science degree in nutrition from Texas Women's University in Denton, Texas. I could be here forever talking about Susan, but I'm just going to tell you she's trained in immunology, adverse food reactions, practical application of dietary management for food-sensitive patients, and she's the real deal with everything that she says and does. And she's got a plethora of, it seems to be my word tonight, credentials and accomplishments. And I believe now she even is a chairperson for the Academy of Nutrition. And she can tell you about that. But you will find her at www.susanlinke.com, and at that, I'm just going to bring her on because it's better to talk to her than it is to hear me talk about her. Hey, Susan.
Hey, Carol. Susan. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for being here. How are you?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I always enjoy being on your show and just talking to you in general. It's always fun.
Oh, you're great. Thanks. So we're gonna just you know what, Susan? I think just for the purposes of this conversation, let's just start out basics. And can we just talk about inflammation for a minute? Talk about what it is.
Sure.
People hear about it all the time. They talk about it on television commercials now, and I'm sure that you know it's attached to a drug of some sort. But you know, people go, oh, inflammation. It's kind of like, for me as a dietitian, it's kind of like the calorie, you know. Oh, too many calories, but they don't really even know what the calorie is or does. But in this case, inflammation. Can you just give us kind of an overview of inflammation?
Sure. I'd be happy to. Inflammation is actually good for you in a sense. It's not necessarily negative. It's your body's natural defense mechanisms. If you cut yourself or if you injure yourself, if we didn't have the immune system to produce that inflammatory response, we would bleed to death. We wouldn't be able to repair tissue. So all of that is actually part of that inflammatory process. So inflammation, normal inflammation, is good for you. The problem is when inflammation becomes chronic. If somebody were to cut themselves and not clean that wound would fester and just get worse and worse and worse. So if we allow inflammation to continue inside of our bodies, the same thing happens. It's almost like internal festering. That inflammation chronically starts to produce inflammatory chemicals called cytokines. There's interleukins, there's prostaglandins, those kinds of names. And those travel through the bloodstream and reach the cell's target tissues and cause symptoms like pain and cramping and fluid retention. They can even affect our mood. And those in turn get labeled like irritable bowel syndrome or asthma. All of these are produced by they're caused by inflammation in many cases. The other thing to keep in mind is that 70% of our immune system is in the gut. So diet is going to play a major role in inflammation. A good diet or an anti-inflammatory diet will reduce inflammation, but a diet that's pro-inflammatory can increase inflammation. And so we always have to maintain that balance toward the anti-inflammatory side so that so that we aren't constantly feeding the inflammation in our bodies.
So, Susan, if somebody's got, you know, I think we should probably outline a little bit why this is important. And so what I did was I just kind of looked up some statistics just to give people an idea as to why this is so important to know about. More than 133 million Americans, or 45% of the population, 45% have at least one chronic condition. And those chronic conditions that Susan's talking about that start out in a certain way that she just described that go to issues like Alzheimer's, dementia, arthritis, asthma, cancer, COPD, Crohn's disease, cystic fibrosis, diabetes, epilepsy, heart disease, just to name a few, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's. And then the other thing to keep in mind is that with each of those conditions comes other things. So you have multiple issues, and Susan, I'm going to let you talk about that in a minute, but I want to make this point. The point is that with there are about 8 prescriptions per condition. And, you know, so that's how people end up on all these medications, because they have one thing that leads to another that leads to another, and all starts from that simple little thing that you just described, Susan. So maybe we can talk about how the compounding of issues starts to play a role in where what people start to experience into those types of headlines.
Mm-hmm. And it's important to point out that the medications that people are on are really addressing the symptoms. They're not really addressing the underlying root in most cases. So you can keep putting a Band-Aid on, and one Band-Aid is going to lead to another Band-Aid. But ultimately, we've got to address the underlying root in order to reverse that process. And the nice thing about the immune system is it's really geared toward fixing itself. Just like when you cut yourself, within seconds, your body starts producing inflammatory chemicals to promote a scab. So if we reverse that process, then many people that have these chronic inflammatory conditions, whether they're migraines or irritable bowel syndrome or rheumatoid arthritis, can actually start to feel better just with some minor changes in their diet, addressing gut health and things like that. A lot of the medications that are used to address some of these issues can actually lead to more issues. For example, medications used for reflux will lower your stomach acid, but stomach acid is very important. It helps digest certain foods. It helps digest B12, for example. It's also needed to help keep bad bacteria at bay. Without enough stomach acid, you have growth of bad bacteria. And when that happens, inflammation also increases. So it's, you know, it's like the hip bones connected to the thigh bone. One thing is connected to the other, and it is a slippery slope. I had a patient one time who went to the doctor with some sort of GI pain, and the doctor gave her a medication that in turn caused a secondary symptom like a headache. So she went back for that, and he gave her a pill for that, and that caused the third symptom. And she went back to the doctor and got she went through this for 5 medications. And finally he said, "Lady, it's just all in your head." And anyway, she fired that doctor, went to another doctor, and found the true cause of her illness. But sometimes the doctors just give, you know, medication, and it just doesn't really solve the issue.
Well, and I think that's an excellent point to make, in that just because we have a symptom, we go to the doctor, we get a pill, and we think it's fixed. We have to be aware of what might be happening internally to make that symptom go away from that pill. Something else has to happen. That pill has to shut something down or stop something that's a natural occurrence in the body. So therefore, you're going to pay for it another way, which is why she had to keep going back. And I think that's an excellent point to just keep kind of reiterating tonight, only because there is a chain reaction, and there are consequences to every decision that we're making. So if we kind of just go back to basics and say, hey, you know, take a look at this, and this is where you are. Let's take care of your gut. Let's make sure that your immune system is functioning appropriately. Those are the basics to just allow the body to do what it's supposed to do. And I don't know that we do a very good job with that traditionally in our country from a healthcare perspective. We're really kind of the pill fixer kind of mentality of, okay, I hurt, so fix it. So, you know, we need to talk about how that is. I mean, these are chronic issues, so they don't occur, they don't occur immediately. They occur over time, and they keep compounding. So when that happens, Susan, and they have a chronic condition, at what stage do you usually see them? What time, you know, what point do you usually get somebody? Do you get them at a point in that chronic inflammatory response that it's pretty far gone? And then let's talk about how you bring them back and what kinds of steps you use.
Okay, let me backtrack. Just something that occurred to me when you were talking, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure.
Is the fact that a lot of these conditions are connected. And a lot, and you know, in our, they don't do this so much in Eastern medicine, but I think in Western medicine, and because of the specialization of doctors, we go to one doctor for the headache, we go to another doctor for the stomach ache, we go to another doctor for the joint pain, and another doctor for thyroid, and we don't realize that a lot of those things, or most of those things, are actually connected, and we end up playing whack-a-mole. Really, you know, we take a medication for one, but if the underlying inflammation is still going, then it's just going to turn into something else. So we've got to deal with that underlying inflammation, or we're just going to be jumping from one condition to another, which is probably why so many people are on multiple medications, because it's all related. And when you have inflammation, in some person it may manifest as a migraine, and somebody else it may manifest as something else, but the underlying root is still usually inflammation.
Right.
And you were talking about a pill for every ill. On the other side of the spectrum, too, what I see sometimes is people come into my office with literally a big shopping bag full of supplements. So you get a pill for every ill on one side of the aisle, and on the other side of the aisle, a lot of times you get a supplement for every ill, and some of those supplements may be addressing deficiencies, which is good, but in other cases, they're also trying to treat symptoms with nutraceuticals. So that's not always the answer either. Oh, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. You go ahead. Finish. Go ahead.
I was going to say the answer, fortunately, can be as simple as changing your diet in many cases. It just depends on how far along somebody is. You know, like John Kennedy said, the time to fix the roof is when the sun is shining. But unfortunately, we're not always motivated to start when we're feeling well. You know, and pizza doesn't bother me, then you know, donuts don't bother me, then with the motivation is just not there, unfortunately. So that you were asking me, when is it that I see patients in my office? And that's usually when they realize, you know, I've got a problem. They've usually been already to multiple doctors, and they realize that this is not going to solve the problem. So that's when they come to me. And fortunately, they come to me because they realize that there is a solution that's a natural solution. So that's a good thing.
Well, I'm going to back up a little bit because I think just by listening to this show tonight, you know, we've got people who are interested in the topic and how it relates. But I have to say, as a person, not as a dietitian, but as a person, when I hear, well, just from my experience in dealing with people, and I'm sure you've felt that you've seen the same thing, that when they hear they have to change their diet, that's like slapping them in the face sometimes. Or they take it. I've even had people take it as a form of punishment. And it's not about that. And we need to kind of stress that. First, I want to just make the point that when we're talking about diet, we're talking about how somebody is eating. We're not talking about weight loss. Because that's the other thing that happens. People say, I'm going on a diet. Well, whatever you eat, however you eat, that is your diet. And that's what we're talking about, changing that. So, but would you agree, Susan, that you know, I just kind of want to make the point that changing the diet doesn't mean that it's a harsh punishment, whatever. It's a matter of health, and it's a matter of when you get to that point that you see them with multiple pills, that I see them with multiple pills and multiple supplements, and they just don't know. They've been to multiple doctors. You know, it's time to kind of get back to the basics that I was talking about earlier, and that's look internally and say, what can I do for me? And if that means I have to make some changes with my foods, then, you know, then I make some changes. Does it mean it's going to be absolutely permanent? Probably not, but maybe. You know, nobody knows at whatever point. But, you know, how do you deal with that? Because I'm sure you've dealt with that a number of times with people, and you know, just kind of overcoming the stigma attached to changing the diet, changing the foods that they eat?
Mm-hmm. Well, in most cases, when, you know, by the time the people come to my door, they're motivated to make some changes. So, but I hear what you're saying. Absolutely. Nobody wants to be miserable. And our society revolves around eating. I mean, that's what we do. Let's go meet for lunch. Let's go meet for dinner,
yeah,
et cetera. So we are a society that meets around the kitchen table or the kitchen island. And I absolutely recognize that. And that's an absolutely valid point. And the good news is, though, that we can change our diet. You know, the way we eat doesn't have to be, you know, eating your string beans and you know, salmon every single night. But we can make very fun things to eat by just making substitutions. One of the types of foods, for example, that are very inflammatory are refined carbohydrates. They increase our glycemic load. That glycemic load, in turn, causes us to produce inflammatory chemicals. But we can substitute such fun things for those refined carbohydrates. Now we can cook with almond meal and cashew meal and coconut flour and make just the most wonderful banana breads and zucchini breads. And in a lot of cases, you'd never even know that those foods were made with alternative types of flours.
True. Very true. So given all of that, let's just kind of regroup for a minute, because we kind of had to throw all of that out there just to get people to understand that just because you're making some changes, the biggest point I want to make based on what you just said, Susan, is when they are making changes and you've made these changes and you actually are committed to doing this, as Susan said, people are motivated to get this done and actually, you know, change some of those habits. Once you do that and you start to feel better, you really don't want to go backwards to where, you know, I've never had anybody that really wanted to go backwards and say, oh, I think I'll feel bad again. You know, they go, no, that's not good for me. And it's a learning experience, but it's also an enlightening experience, which is very cool to watch. It's very rewarding for the person doing it, because it's like, wow, I did it myself. You know, I did some things myself. And I think that's important to talk about too, the benefits that people receive from that. So we've talked about the inflammation, we talked about what it is, we talked about what it causes, we talked about what place they need to get to, and then we talked about what kinds of things that they might have to change. But now let's talk a little bit about, let's say you take a patient that comes into you, or a client that comes into you. Where do you start? Where does that person start? You can't just throw everything at them. So how do you break it down to make it as easy of an approach as possible?
Well, to be honest, first of all, you'd want to look at their diet. You can make some simple changes. I always take people where they are. What do you normally eat for breakfast? What do you normally eat for lunch and dinner? And then we'll make a slow transition and start making some substitutions that they feel like they can live with. If they normally eat, if they normally make a smoothie, I'll just teach them how to make a smoothie with maybe substituting a nut milk instead of a regular cow's milk. Or, you know, maybe you can put some of this in your smoothie or that in your smoothie, and just making some changes like that. If they normally eat, you know, eggs for breakfast, which are good, why don't we put some vegetables in your omelet? And, you know, making some additions like that, because adding vegetables is a very important part of the anti-inflammatory diet. So looking for places to put it. A lot of times you can put vegetables in smoothies even. You know, you put some spinach in with a banana and some things, and it tastes good. So you make a smoothie with a Granny Smith apple, and you put a carrot juice in there, and it makes it taste really good. So there's a lot of tricks for making really fun stuff, and most people actually see it as an adventure where they try things they've never tried before and really find out that they enjoy them. And I like desserts and snacks as much as anybody else. So I've learned how to make, you know, banana bread, or you can make a chocolate zucchini bread with coconut flour and almond meal and things like that. So you can make them with really healthy ingredients, but they still taste really good. Or maybe make a sauce for your chicken. Instead of using flour as like an Alfredo, you could even use cashews to make a sauce like that. So it really is fun. And another thing is, it doesn't have to take a lot of time, because people just don't have time to spend a lot of time in the kitchen. But it doesn't take a lot of time to make a lot of these changes.
Right. Well, so let's talk about food sensitivity, and let's talk about what that means versus an allergy versus why it's important, and the differences in testing and what people need to know, because, you know, there's a lot of food sensitivity tests out there, and there are a lot of doctors who offer food sensitivity testing, which doesn't mean that it's bad, it doesn't mean it's good, it just means How can the average person know if that test is right for them? And if their doctor's saying, this is the test for you, you know, when they get their results, what are they supposed to do? So let's just kind of break it down a little bit, talk about what you use, talk about what you and I are familiar with, and kind of give them an idea of what food sensitivities are and why they're important to the inflammatory process and what happens.
Sure. And first, you know, perhaps the need for food sensitivity testing. And the reason is, and somebody that's just trying to be healthy and be proactive probably wouldn't need food sensitivity testing. But once you've developed a chronic condition, then you develop food sensitivities. And a lot of times you develop food sensitivities to very healthy foods. The reality is, you can have a food sensitivity to almost anything except for maybe baking soda, salt, carbonated water, or white vinegar. But beyond that, you can react to salmon. You can have a food sensitivity to turmeric or ginger or vanilla, anything, salmon. So identifying those food sensitivities becomes really tough for a few reasons. One of them is, you don't always feel inflammation. Cardiovascular disease, multiple sclerosis, arthritis. I mean, you feel arthritis, but you can't really tell necessarily what particular food is causing that joint pain. So there's a lot of foods that are causing that inflammation, and you don't feel it. So trying to figure it out by removing a food and seeing how you feel doesn't always work. Another reason it doesn't work is because most people have way more than one food sensitivity. Most people react, the testing that we do looks at 140 foods and 30 chemicals. And out of 140 foods, most people react to about 30. That's about 20%. So if you're just removing one food or two or three, and trying to see if you feel better, you might feel a little bit better, but you're definitely not going to be able to identify all of those foods. And so that's when testing becomes necessary, because you've never figured it out otherwise. Some things people do, you know, by trial and error, they can figure out some, but they never figure them out 100%. It just doesn't happen. And another danger with trying to pull stuff out, I've had people come into my office where they're down to five foods, literally down to five foods, because they become scared to eat. They start pulling out a food, and they start pulling out another food, and they start pulling out another food, and pretty much they're down to a really limited diet. And then that compounds the problem, because then they develop nutrient deficiencies, which can also cause you to feel bad and can contribute to chronic illness and inflammation. So it's really a downward spiral. So the nice thing about testing is it can really help us hone in very quickly on what foods that you need to be eating safely so that we can avoid eating those foods that you have a sensitivity to. And as far as the test, or I don't want to keep talking. Did you want to say anything, Carol, before
I keep
going? Oh, go ahead.
You're good.
Going?
Go ahead.
Okay.
I'm with you.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. So there's a variety of food sensitivity tests out there, and the one I use is called Mediator Release Test. There's a difference between food allergies and food sensitivities. I'll start there. And some people come to my office saying, I've been tested for food allergies and, you know, I'm only allergic to dust mites or something, or, you know, one thing or two things. The problem with food allergy testing is that in most cases, irritable bowel syndrome, migraines, rheumatoid arthritis, and many of those conditions don't have allergy as the base. They actually have a delayed type hypersensitivity reaction as the culprit. So as good as allergy testing might be for certain conditions, it's not the adequate test for a lot of the chronic conditions that a lot of people have, like the ones I just mentioned. So food sensitivities involve different types of mechanisms, different types of antibodies and T cells, so it requires a different type of testing for that reason. And the testing that I do is really the most comprehensive because it looks at the inflammatory chemicals produced by both the antibody side of the equation plus the T cell side of the equation. So it's the most comprehensive. The other thing that makes it different than other food sensitivity testing is that most people, when they go to their allergist or to their doctor and they get their test results back, in most cases, those doctors will tell you to avoid your reactive foods. And they'll give you your list, just don't eat the soy, don't eat the corn, and away you go. Well, the problem with that approach is most grocery stores have 42,000 items in the store. Yes, a lot of repeats, but still a lot of foods. And we have thousands of additives in our food supply. So you're never, ever going to have a test large enough to identify all of your food triggers. That's impossible. So what good does it do you? I mean, it does a little bit of good, but what good does it do you if you avoid some, but you continue to eat other sources of inflammation? It's like throwing water and matches on the fire at the same time. If you want to feel 100% better, doesn't it make sense to avoid 100% of your reactive foods? Absolutely. So, but how do you do that if there's no test large enough to test for all of your food triggers? Well, the approach that we take solves that problem. What we do is when we get the list of your safe foods, the ones that were not reactive, that actually becomes your diet for about 4 weeks. If you're eating only the foods that were tested and safe, then by default, you will be avoiding not just your tested reactives, but you'll also avoid your untested reactive foods. And in theory, we can avoid 100% of your reactive foods because you're not eating anything that's untested and questionable. We're giving you a list of the things you can put in your grocery cart that is not going to produce inflammation. And with that approach, most people feel 50 to 80% better in just 10 days. It seems, you know, I've been doing this for 13 years and it still blows my mind every time because the speed at which the immune system and the body can recover is just amazing. You know, I had one client, for example, who had been on sick leave for 10 months because he couldn't leave his apartment. His diarrhea was so bad. And so he was 51 years old, starting to get suicidal because he thought his life was over and he couldn't go back to work. And in 10 days, that man was back at work after being on sick leave for so long. And, you know, because if the immune system is not receiving any fiery darts, it just has nothing more to react to and it calms down. It's kind of it sounds simplistic, but it's pretty powerful.
And well, you know, I've had the same kind of results. I haven't done as many people as you have, but, you know, I had a 22-year-old who was in college and wanted to go to med school, but couldn't even get through his basic classes without having to run to the bathroom constantly, and it was to a point where his surgeon wanted to take out a section of his colon. And the only reason I got involved was because his father was at a point where he just like said, help my son because I don't want him to have this surgery if he doesn't need it. So I said, okay, let's go with that. And again, within 10 days, he was able to sit through an entire class, and he was concerned about, he had midterms coming up, and he was concerned about even testing. He thought he was going to quit school. He was completely depressed. They were worried about him mentally, and he was able to take the test, sit through the whole class, and get through the rest of the semester just by changing his foods around and doing the test that you're talking about, the MRT. So it is pretty phenomenal. It does really still blow my mind when it happens with people, and you know, it's just something that we are not prone to think about in this society. We just go for the pill, we go for the surgery. We don't think about the foods that we put in or that the foods could be causing us distress in any way. It's like, well, that's just normal. That's what I normally eat. How can that be causing me a problem? So I appreciate you going through all of that. I kind of wanted to expand this a little bit more into maybe some outlying issues, kind of like autism and some other inflammatory responses that are not necessarily just limited to inflammation, but how food sensitivities can help with that, change in diet can help with that, and how the entire immune system can be enhanced in those situations as well.
And I don't particularly work with autism, although we've had some wonderful testimonials. I did work with one 2-year-old, and that particular 2-year-old was not having any eye contact at all. And the mom read about the potential effects of gluten and dairy on autism. So, and he was categorized as lowest functioning autism. And so she took him off of dairy and gluten, and within 8 days, he made eye contact and gave her her first kiss. Within 30 days, he went from lowest functioning autism to highest functioning autism. And then we added the MRT on top of that, and he's no longer on the spectrum. Was he correctly diagnosed? I don't know. But there was an allergist I used to work at whose own son had autism, and he said that not everybody responds to a gluten and dairy-free diet, but when they do, he found that MRT helped them even 50% more than just taking them off gluten and dairy. Another group of conditions, too, are the autoimmune conditions and celiac disease. That might be worth talking about, too. One out of 100, roughly, of healthy people have celiac disease, and that causes that's related to a lot of autoimmune conditions, and there's over 100 autoimmune conditions, Crohn's disease, arthritis, autoimmune hepatitis, Sjogren's syndrome, type 1 diabetes, probably one of the most common is autoimmune thyroid also. And so if you have any sort of autoimmune condition, you probably should be screened to make sure you don't have celiac disease, because if you have type 1 diabetes, for example, you have a 6% chance roughly of having celiac disease. If you have multiple sclerosis.
Say that again. Can you repeat that? It kind of broke
have,
up.
Yeah. Yep. If you have type 1 diabetes, you have a 6% chance of having celiac disease. If you have multiple sclerosis, you have an 11% chance of having celiac disease. And I don't know the statistic for Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which is the autoimmune form, but most cases of, I do, it's 6%. Most cases of autoimmune thyroid or thyroid disease are autoimmune in nature. And a lot of doctors will only test for TSH or maybe T4, but they're not looking at the thyroid antibodies. So always have, you know, if you have thyroid disease, which many people do, just make sure that doctor's checking for your thyroid antibodies, because if that's the case, then the thyroid is the victim. It is not the perpetrator. And by dealing with the immune system, many times we can improve that thyroid condition. So, and celiac disease, you know, 93% of people that have celiac disease don't know that they have it. And it affects, again, 1 out of every 100, 1% of Americans. So if you have osteoporosis, if you have an autoimmune condition, whether or not you have the classic symptoms, which most people don't, ask your doctor to check and make sure you don't have celiac disease also.
That's an excellent point to make. I think that you know, everybody, well, not everybody, but the buzzword of today is gluten-free. But I find that a lot of people don't even know why it's a good thing to do or why it might be important, or that some people don't even know that other people get sick if they eat gluten. They just think that it's the thing to restrict these days. So I'm glad you made that point. I want to remind everybody that if you're listening and you want to ask a question and you've called in, to press the number 1 to get in the queue for questions. That'll let me know that you have a question, and that you know, we'll call out the last 4 digits of your phone number so that you know it's you on the air. So if you want to ask Susan a question, she's right here. She's happy to do so. Susan, given all of this information, what would you think, or what do you think about the fact that you know, if I'm just listening to this program, my head might be spinning a little bit. Should I do anti-inflammatory? Should I do food sensitivity? Should I do nothing? What is the best approach? So maybe, you know, you talked a little bit about some anti-inflammatory foods, but maybe just to get people on the right track, to kind of give them a feel for what they should be doing, maybe we should talk a little bit about the anti-inflammatory diet in general without the food sensitivity component and the kinds of foods that bring down that inflammation.
Sure.
Just naturally.
In general, one way to prevent inflammation is not to stoke the fire to begin with. So reducing our refined carbohydrate intake, which is the white flour, the white sugar, those kinds of things, and eating more whole foods, the fruits, the vegetables, foods that, you know, grass-fed meats and things like that. Then also, when you eat out or when you go to the grocery store, focus more on those foods in the produce aisle and stay away from processed foods as much as you can. Also, reducing your caloric intake. When you have increased adiposity or increased fat, that fat also produces inflammatory cytokines. Consuming too much alcohol can also be inflammatory. Foods that are prebiotic or probiotic in nature. So your gut bacteria are very, very important to your health, and you can eat foods that are feeding that good bacteria. Those are called prebiotics. And some foods that are rich in prebiotics would be asparagus and bananas and dandelion greens and garlic and jicama and legumes and onions and peas, etc. So, you know, without memorizing a list, I think in general, if you eat a diet that has a lot of variety and foods that are high in antioxidants and phytochemicals, you're naturally going to be, some of those will by default be prebiotic food. So you don't have to run around with a list when you go to the grocery store. I think the key really is variety. The more color on your plate, the more types of healthy fats that you eat also, that will ensure that you eat enough probiotic foods and even prebiotic foods. Prebiotic foods are the ones that feed the good bacteria. The probiotic foods actually contain bacteria themselves, like the yogurt with the live cultures, kefir, and things like that. Fats are really, really important also, because some types of fats, like the trans fats, for example, that are found in fried foods, those are inflammatory. So eating a mixture of some saturated fats, like grass-fed butter, coconut oil, grass-fed meat, but also a mix of monounsaturated or polyunsaturated fats, so things that you get from avocados and olive oil and walnut oil and flaxseed oil, things like that. So using a variety of healthy oils along with a variety of fruits and vegetables and minimizing our intake of refined carbohydrate is just a general healthy way to eat.
Well, and I think those are just excellent points in general, because people know, but they don't know. So thank you for kind of going over that in terms that make it easy for people. You know, the color on the plate, that makes it very easy, so that it's not something that people have to stress over. Because I find that when people are trying to eat or eat right, they stress. And mm-hmm. I always tell people, you know what, there really are no diet police, you know. So how you're eating, there's not somebody that's going to, like, come and arrest you, but you need to just kind of know what, you know what we're saying to you, know what we're talking about, and give yourself a break. You're not going to always be perfect with this either. So that's important to know as well. Nobody's expecting perfection, but the more that you do this, the better off your body is, and the benefits to your body you will start to see and feel. And it's just kind of like, it just kind of happens, and then it becomes a way of life. So all of that being said, we have just a few more minutes. We're almost out of time again. This is usually what happens on the show. If we were to wrap this up and talk about chronic inflammation and what foods got to do with it, go back to the title, what would you say? Is there anything else that you would want to say that we haven't said?
If you have a chronic inflammatory condition, there's hope. That's the main message. The body is an amazing machine that's geared toward fixing itself, and I think we don't even grasp the power that diet has over our health, and that's because 70% of our immune system is in our gut, and that's why it has such a profound effect on our health. And sometimes it's really hard to fathom, well, how can changing my diet improve my arthritis? It just seems like a stretch. But when you realize that the foods themselves are producing the inflammation that travels through the bloodstream and reaches those joints, then it makes that connection a little bit more clear. And when we identify which foods are safe for you to eat that are not causing the production, we can actually stop that process, and there's no more fiery darts being fired through the bloodstream to those target tissues. And if we just put out the fire, then there's no more fire. It sounds simplistic, but it really is very, very powerful. So there's definitely hope.
Thank you for that. Hey, we do have a blog question. It says, I travel all the time. I happen to be home tonight, so I thought I would listen. Thank you for that. Appreciate that, you know, if you're not home a lot and you're listening to this show, that's great. Thank you so much. I have rheumatoid arthritis, and I know I should do anti-inflammatory foods. How can I do this on the road? We didn't talk about that. We're going to talk about how people can do this kind of on the go kind of thing.
Okay. And I'll address real quick, too, if you have an autoimmune condition like rheumatoid arthritis, please ask your doctor to check your vitamin D levels. Vitamin D is very important for gut health. It helps regulate gut integrity, which causes leaky gut. And it seems to be very highly correlated with autoimmune conditions. Almost always, when somebody has an autoimmune condition, their vitamin D level is going to be on the low side. And so if you want to get better, one of the steps is to normalize that vitamin D level. So please do that. Also, when you travel, thank goodness there's an ever-increasing amount of restaurants that are very healthy. The other day I got on the internet and I just Googled healthy restaurants Dallas, and I was very pleasantly surprised at how many of them, you know, like Andrew Wild's True Food Kitchen, or there were very many like that are now serving very healthy foods. So that would be one way, you know, when you choose to eat out, look for those healthy restaurants and just Google as simple as healthy restaurants in whatever city that you happen to be in. And I'm finding a lot more of those at airport. I travel a lot as well, and I'm finding more healthy options at airports. Or airlines allow you to take your food on the airplane. The only thing you can't take through security are liquids. But you can definitely take food, so you can pack something. If you know you're going to be from point A to point B and you're going to be a while, pack a to-go lunch that you can take with. And if you're driving, plan ahead of time. Look and see what healthy restaurants are going to be down the road so you can plan, you know, I'm going to leave at this time so that I can be at such and such a place at that time.
Great. You know what? I just Googled Healthy Restaurants Orlando when you were talking, and I'm looking at these restaurants, and I've been to a lot of them, and they are great restaurants, a lot of great places I don't need to worry about because I'm restricted. I do a lot. I follow food sensitivities, and I follow a gluten-free diet. So I've been to a lot of these places, and they're excellent. So thank you for that tip. I didn't even think to do that myself, to do the Healthy Foods Orlando thing. So thank you. So, Susan, we've got about 6 minutes left. We've got people listening on the phones. If you want to ask a question, please press the number one. But I would like to take these next 6 minutes and kind of just I want to go back to something that you said a little earlier when you were talking about putting smoothies together and combining the foods. And I remember you saying the banana with the spinach and the Granny Smith apple with something else. You know, that might be kind of a foreign concept for people to put fruits and vegetables together in a blender and make it come out okay. So do you have any, tried and true recipes that you want to share that kind of jumpstart people for the morning or in the middle of the day or something?
You know, there's a lot of Pinterest pages now that you can go to, and you can put in healthy smoothies on Pinterest. But you basically want a protein source if you can, and then you want a healthy fat, and then you want a base. And ideally, you probably don't want fruit juice for a base because that's going to be higher on the glycemic scale. But you can use a nut milk, an almond milk, a pecan milk, cashew milk, something like that. And then whatever you want for flavor, and berries are good. There's a lot of strawberries, blueberries that have a real high antioxidant content, so you can add that for flavor. So start with bold. Just figure out what you don't have to start with the complicated stuff, but try a few flavors. Look on Pinterest or on the internet for healthy smoothies. And you're going to find a lot of combinations that look really refreshing with maybe some pineapple or whatnot. And usually a lot of people, you know, the Granny Smith and the carrots, that's a pretty common one. And the spinach with the banana is another common one. So there are certain combinations that seem to work well like that, and you will find them on Pinterest. So that would be just an easy way. So look and see what's appetizing to you, but the main thing is just make sure there's a protein source in there. That'll carry you longer, because if it's a smoothie that's just full of sugar, then that's going to be a little bit counterproductive. But the protein in there and the fat can be a little bit of walnut oil in there, or you can even put some almond butter in there, or just the healthy fat from the almond milk can also be good. But that'll keep you fuller longer. And as far as the protein, you can use egg white protein powder, for example, or there's pea protein powder, pumpkin protein powder, hemp protein powder. There's a lot of good protein powders that you can get at the health food store, and add those to your smoothies as well.
I like pea protein myself. I find that it kind of gives a nutty flavor to whatever it is that I'm doing, and it just kind of sticks with you a little longer. But you know, whatever protein is out there that you want to use is a great option. So Susan, thank you. That coupled with a food sensitivity component, I think it's important that we kind of take the next couple of minutes that we have left and just say, you know, there's a lot to learn about inflammation, but the biggest thing and Susan, let me know if you agree with this, but the biggest thing is that if you're experiencing some kind of inflammatory condition, being aware of it, number one, is the first step, and understanding that it's not just all related to taking a pill or, you know, kind of feeling relief and taking another pill for something else that we talked about earlier, that you can, in fact, control some of the things that are happening with you on a great scale. So, you know, the power is with you. And that, I think, is a message that we don't get out often enough. You do have the power. I do a lot of things on this show. I do both. I do some holistic things on this show. I do alternative things on this show. We talk a lot about the internal power that we have energetically. We talk about, you know, things that we can do, but with this particular thing, you can actually just take control of you and your body and make a world of difference for yourself. And Susan, you know, the results that you get, the things that you do, the accomplishments and the results for your patients have just been phenomenal. And I can't thank you enough, and I can't say enough how much I always appreciate what you have to say, and I always learn something from you. You know, every conversation that we have, I'm always learning from you. So I'm expressing much gratitude tonight. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Carol. I really appreciate being a guest on your show, and I know you have a heart for people. I have a heart for people, and really what we want to do really is just help people get better. And the good news is they can. We're here to empower people so that they can get better.
Absolutely. True story there. But you had a quote earlier from JFK. I think we should end the show on that quote.
Absolutely. And the time to fix the roof is when the sun is shining. So, you know, sometimes it takes 20, 30 years to develop dementia or Alzheimer's, and those are inflammatory conditions as well. So even if you know, think about the rest of your family and, you know, maybe grandkids that you want to, whose lives you want to be a part of, or other family members or loved ones, it really is, when we take care of ourselves, we really are taking care of those that we love too.
Excellent point. Couldn't have said it better, Susan. Thank you. On that note, we're going to say goodnight. We're going to say thank you to Susan, and Susan, you're a guest that's invited back at any point in time that you would like to join us. So, thank you for that, for just being everything that you always are.
Well,
to this show.
Thank you again for having me. Thank you.
And with that, we're going to see you in a couple of weeks. And we're going to be talking, you know, I always do a show every year, at least one or two shows on our furry members of the family. And we're actually going to be taking on a subject that is very difficult for most of us who own animals. And we're going to be talking about pet grief and losing those wonderful companions that we have and how to deal with it. And we have a wonderful counselor coming on that deals with this with people all the time. So join us in 2 weeks, and we will have Judy Sharus on, and she is with Winter Park Lost Pets, and we'll talk about that. So everybody have a great week too, and we'll see you the next time. Susan, we'll talk about the next time you're coming back, okay?
All right.
All
right. Thank you, Carol. I enjoy it.
All right. Good night, everybody. We're going to say good night.